It's 2020 and the world is changing. Race relations are being debated at a global level after the murder of George Floyd. It's also 2020 and the African integration is in full speed. More than 23 African countries have signed up to the Single African Air Transport Market. The African Continental Free Trade Agreement is normally effective by July the 1st. And then it's 2020, the year COVID-19 became a global pandemic. Within 2 months, economies are in shambles. The Black Lives Matter protests on the global stage are somewhat dampened, and countries all over are closing their borders. In this episode, I wanted to explore how those things are connected, and I found the right person to break it down for us. Meet Dr. Rita Kiki Edoje. Dr. Edoje is a professor of global governance, Department of Conflict Resolution, Human Security and Global Governance at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. She is also an associate dean at McCormick Graduate School. Dr. Edoje holds a PhD in politics, and she has been a teacher, scholar, and an academic administrator of graduate education and undergrad studies for 20 years. She has published 7 books and several journal articles and book chapters, and she is currently working on her latest book, Africa's New Role in Global Politics, forthcoming in 2021. She is an expert in African affairs and politics, global development, comparative democratization, international relations, international political economy, race, and identity. Dr. Edoje, welcome.
Thank you.
What kind of effect do you think COVID-19 is going to have on the African continental free trade area?
Well, you know, I think the new Secretary General of the AFCFTA has actually acknowledged that COVID has, and his word was, you know, yielded a setback, you know, so if you call that slowing down, absolutely, you know, but I think the gains or the wins, you know, regarding, you know, that integrated trade agreement for Africa, really great, you know, sort of plus before COVID, were made then when we got Nigeria on board and, you know, we got the last, you know, remaining African holdouts on board to at least sign up to the initiative. You know, I think the win was then. Now, you know, with COVID, you know, it's a global pandemic, not just a regional pandemic. And so, you know, it affects travel the most, travel of goods and services, you know, as well as people. This is the phase of the plan where there is a lot of human capital that would be required and therefore a lot of negotiated meetings, therefore travel. And so, you know, it has slowed it down. You know, it's a small setback, but I think that, you know, once, you know, we all get beyond, you know, this tragic public health crisis that is global, you know, I think it'll be a setback.
It's going to be a setback, that's for sure. Although some see in it an opportunity, meaning COVID is going to push us to trade more between one another. And yeah, I want to believe that, but I fear the opposite.
I feel your fear as well. You know, there's a great article, and I'm forgetting the author's name. She was actually a European Union, you know, fellow or something. She's got this wonderful article around African responses to COVID that even the African Union posted on its website because it was so, you know, sort of, you know, satisfied with, you know, the ways in which this fellow was articulating the African response. Just the name of the title of the article was The African Union, an Island of Internationalism, which I found, you know, sort of incredibly poignant in terms of capturing for change the valuable, you know, I think, you know, capacities, regional integration, and how far, you know, the African Union has come in, you know, fostering, you know, the political negotiated sort of solidarity and unity that requires to, you know, move Africa along. But this article very rightly, you know, celebrated, you know, Africa's response, continental-wide response to COVID in ways that other regions did not have, including the European Union initially, you know, took a national, you know, state-to-state response, closing borders, Whereas this article showed that Africans did not. Africans immediately, you know, put in place, at least at the continental level, the mechanisms that they had built, you know, to respond to previous public health crises like Ebola, where they had not, you know, been very successful. And so now they were ready to put in these mechanisms at the continental wide level. And there was a lot of cooperation. And so, you know, let's look at the, you know, give and take, you know. I mean, I know in this interview, I'm going to talk a little bit about the eco and the Afro and the, you know, you know, other sort of limitations, you know, that, you know, African Union and African unity has. But notwithstanding, I think there is a strong, you know, will among Africans. We've got good leadership now, even with the new commissioner. Well, he's not so new anymore, but, you know, Faki is a, you know, strong leader, you know, to foster union and integrated union. And so I think the AEC, the AF, the CFTA is sort of part of that, you know, a Kagame pledge that we've got to, you know, get this going. And and we do.
Now, considering these blocks of Francophones and Anglophones, Lusophones and Arabophones, how much of a drag are they to an African integration?
I saw that question, Samba, and, you know, I've written extensively on subjects of Pan-Africanism and more specifically the African Union. My 2017 book, maybe it was 2015, I'm sorry, The African Union's Africa, was actually about the African Union. And my current book, which will be my eighth book, is not necessarily about the African Union, but it is, you know, a book about what I'm calling Africa's new internationalism. And my thesis is that, you know, that internationalism or that, you know, sort of globalization of African politics is driven by the African Union, that African states have collectively delegated, you know, significant, you know, global governance authority to the African Union. And so the African Union becomes this regional international organization. So, you know, going back to, you know, what are the, you know, the limitations in the book that I wrote in 2014, The African Union's Africa, you know, I some people said, oh, I was overly optimistic. I tend to be an optimist, you know, in my own style, you know, and so that could be true. But I do write about, I want to always, you know, get away from, you know, the notion that I feel sometimes my colleagues in the West especially designated African, everything African politics as failure, failed democracy, failed politics. And, you know, my feeling is that that can only be part of the story, right? You know, and so I've always wanted to, you know, sort of look into the complexity of, you know, African social science and especially politics. And, you know, for this book on the African Union, I traveled to Addis Ababa, to the African Union headquarters, and spent, you know, considerable time interviewing the, you know, members, you know, of the union. And, you know, I came away saying, you know, this captures, you know, is there a notion of Africa? Well, yes, because, you know, we are unity in diversity. And so as I, you know, walked around the headquarters, I saw, you know, different languages spoken, you know, sometimes more European languages, but I noticed Swahili, I noticed my native Igbo, I noticed, you know, Luo or even Wolof. I also noticed very different phenotypes, and I would always predict, you know, what part of the region of Africa they were from, including those from Madagascar and, or, you know, South Africa or, you know, Egypt, not to speak of your native Senegal or my Nigeria. Yeah. And I could tell dressing as well. And I came away, you know, writing about this, the diversity of, you know, Africa in terms of, and so most people talk about the diversity in terms of the way you have framed it now, which is your colonial linguistic inputs. And you know, that's important. It's important, you know, history of Africa, that we were colonized by different European powers, and they left their imprint through my natural languages are both English and Igbo, you know. So, but I think, you know, so worse than the fact that we have these linguistic diversities, worse is the fact that what is really going on in terms of the mitigations of African unity is when we've got France-Afrique, you know, for example, a whole swath of Africa alleging to France, or we have Anglophone Africa. The Anglophones tend to be a bit more decentralized. Nobody really alleges to the UK anymore.
Yes.
But there is this sort of, you know, American, you know, orientation that, you know, Anglos tend to have. You know, so those are the, you know, those are still, you know, superpowers, or, you know, sort of dominant, you know, global actors, you know, that, you know, have a lot of power, you know, over Africa, right? Yeah. You know, and, you know, so those are the forces, you know, that mitigate, you know, African unity and integration, even within the continent. An example is just trade, right? You know, we've got these small African countries that have these bilateral, you know, relations with their former colonial powers. And, you know, both sides want to maintain that. But, you know, that mitigates against, you know, the new trading geographies that the AFCFTA wants to, you know, organize, and the ECO as well. So yes, there's going to be linguistic differences that mitigate, you know, our unity. But I do tell you that, you know, we can, and we do most of the time, transcend that, right? You know, I visited Addis Ababa around 2013, 14, when Madam Zuma was just about to take the helm. And there was a contested, you know, election. Yeah. Between former AU commissioner at the time, I'm forgetting his name, from Gabon, you know, it was French speaking versus English speaking, nasty politics saying that South Africa, being a, you know, leading donor, should not put forth a candidate. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, there was a gender option. There was, you know, a lot of factors, you know, that ultimately informed the merit of the diversity of the candidate that we did get.
The divisions we see today in West Africa, in the ECOWAS region, between French-speaking countries and English-speaking countries, when it comes to monetary policies with the Francefa and the ECO. What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's been a theory of African politics, that French colonialism, because of its civilizational, you know, sort of imprint on French Africa, you know, France-Afrique, you know, the sort of post-colonial, if you want to call them neo-colonial, you know, sort of bonds, you know, stayed and remain, right? You know, but that's one part of the story, right? You know, the other part of the story is that you know, real empirical existence has been challenged by, you know, several, you know, Francophone African countries, including Guinea, although, you know, Guinea, you know, during decolonization, right?
Guinea of Secretariat.
Right, under Secretariat. More recently, the whole Ivory Coast struggle after Coupe passed on, you know, under Gbagbo, you know, which continues even, you know, with Ouattara, you know, has been one of, you know, struggling for Ivorite supremacy from France, right? You know, and of course, you know, France, you know, fights it, right? You know, wants to remain and have its influence, you know, Africa as usual. So there's been that contestation. But down to the ECOWAS, you know, I was surprised that we ultimately, our first phase of the ECO will be that the CFO West Africa will turn into an ECO, right? You know, and so I used to think it would be, the Anglophone countries in West Africa that would lead the way, and that they would try to pull, you know, the CFO, you know, in the French-speaking Africa, West Africa, you know, away from France into the fold. That the French countries, French African-speaking countries, would be the real problem, not the Anglophone problem. Yep. But, you know, this raises the complexity of, you know, the challenge that African, you know, politics has moving forward in terms of integrating. And, you know, as I wrote in that book in 2014, okay, and my current, I want to, you know, be positive in looking at, you know, the incremental ways in which change is occurring in Africa. So the good news is that the CFA, you know, at least in West Africa, has been retired, right? You know, and that, you know, at least there was a recognition by the French West African countries that, you know, this was a singular sort of a colonial, not even a neo-colonial, because really, you shouldn't have your monetary systems, you know, held by, you know, the French, right? You know, that needed to be, you know, changed. And that has happened, you know, right? You know, and that the French West African countries are the ones who hold out for, will first implement the ECO. However, what about the Anglo countries? What's going on? So it becomes a bit more complicated. And this is where we have to look, you know, sort of within, you know, the complications of, you know, African regional politics. ECOWAS is 70% in population Nigerian, and it's 52% in GDP. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. It's 70% GDP and 52% in population, right? You know, and so Nigerian multinational state itself, you know, trying to make sense of its own pluralism and, you know, federation within that, right? With all the tensions and opportunities that come from, you know, that itself.
Yeah.
You know, how much, you know, power is it willing to cede to become a larger part of a larger sort of West African federated state, right? You know, particularly, you know, in terms of, you know, its currency and its economy. You know, and these are questions that, you know, like you see in the UK and Brexit, you know, won't be answered, you know, easily, right? You know, they have to be sort of negotiated, they have to be phased in. So take the ECO as a, you know, there were about four options anyway that were presented in the 2009, you know, sort of agreement. And we've gone with the first option, which is a sort of hybrid ECO with, you know, Anglophone currencies remaining, you know, what they are, right?
Separate.
You know, exactly. With the hope that, you know, ultimately, you know, we'll get to all countries using the ECO. Still a lot to be negotiated, still a lot to be worked out.
Yeah.
You know, so that's really sort of how I pragmatically, you know, see what's going on. At the same time, I think that we should see it as a win, a plus, that, you know, French West Africa is waking up. The whole world, quite frankly, is deglobalizing. Deglobalizing could mean fractured, you know, nation states, or it could mean, you know, regionalization, right? You know,
right.
And I think for Africa, it's going to mean regionalization.
We need some sort of unity to have any sort of leverage. COVID-19 is a good example. I mean, we all know it's going to hit us hard. We're talking about freezing debt payment or even debt forgiveness. But what leverage do we have?
Yeah. I mean, Africa's problem has always been, you know, that kind of lack of leverage, quite frankly, you know, with the more powerful, you know, regions of the world. Let's put it like that. The current book that I'm writing about African internationalism or Africa's new global politics, you know, addresses this question. It's a critical question, Samba, because, you know, so for example, I say in that book, great, you know, Africa launches the, you know, African Continental Free Trade Area. You know, it's heralded even by the Western press as potentially the largest free trade, you know, zone in the world. But in reality, we know that, you know, Africans have been good with, you know, sort of rhetorical, you know, pronouncements. But in reality, you know, how much power do Africans have to negotiate and navigate and engage complex, you know, global political economies? Now, one reason why Senegal, Nigeria, you know, South Africa, small Rwanda, you know, all sort of delegate to the African Union is because they accept Kwame's dream. They accept, you know, we're too small, right? You know, little Rwanda doesn't have much power relative to France or to, you know, the United States. So when we come together, you know, we consolidate that power and, you know, sort of use it more effectively for global engagement, right? You know, and so we do want, you know, the African Union to be able to, you know, speak to some of these questions for us. Now, one example is, as you say, you know, renegotiating, you know, debt. Let's move away from that. You know, I've always said Africans, we need to generate our own, you know, sort of wealth, right? You know, within the continent. Yeah. And the African Union, you know, realizes that. The African Free Trade Area, that's its first goal. It says we want to industrialize, you know. Yeah. You know, the West dismisses such a goal, if not on environmental terms, but, you know, on terms where, you know, they want to be the ones to continue to dominate the, you know, sort of industrial capital, you know, markets and send us their products, right? You know, and so here is a real tension. And so even though, you know, the West and the African Union talks about partnerships, those partnerships are really embedded with, you know, asymmetries, you know, where the West usually still gets its interests and Africans, you know, sort of still get aid, you know. But, you know, this has to change, and this is what is the biggest challenge, you know, for, I think, the African Union and for African countries collectively, is to be able to exercise real, you know, power. Yep. That comes to their own interests. Now, you see, I think, pockets of change. When FACI, I think it was 2 years ago, 2019 actually, December 2018, in speaking to the the French and to the Europeans and to the Americans who have a plan for Africa, you know, however, that plan included Africans not, you know, dealing with China, you know, and claiming, you know, sign up to our plan, Africa. However, you know, deal with us in the West, not China. China is not good for you. And Faki's response and Kagame's response is, you know, we choose our own partners. You know, don't infantilize us. This is, you know, the 21st century. You know, we're not going to engage in, you know, global partnerships with you if you're going to talk down to us. You know, China is a competitive partner just as you are, right? You know, so, you know, of course, the West now said, you know, claims that Faki is arrogant, he's uppity, you know, but this is all the, you know, features of, you know, racism, global racism, right? You know, Africa won't speak for itself, you know? But look, Faki does take that kind of leadership, as did Zuma, that kind of leadership. You know, Africans on the ground are also, you know, fed up with, you know, being stigmatized and being marginalized when we know that most of the mineral resources, you know, are taken from Africa, right? And so, you know, we hope the change will not happen just because Faki said we choose our own partners. However, it's a start.
It's a start. Right?
And my study shows that, you know, what the more detailed, you know, things that, you know, the African Union is doing to build capacity and be able to, you know, speak and act, you know, in ways whereby we can protect Africa's interests first, even when we're, you know, requesting sort of, yeah, global, you know, funding for, yeah, things.
Definitely. The narrative has to change. And for that to happen, we need to own the narrative. And our own press, our own local press, has to highlight the good things that are happening on the continent.
One thing to quickly interject is related to COVID-19 and, you know, the complication of this kind of problem, right? You know, whereby, I mean, I know you're aware of the whole sort of Twitter campaign, Africans are not a lab rat, right? Which was inspired by the reaction, legitimate reaction to French journalists or scientists, you know, on the media saying that vaccines should first be tested in Africa because, you know, just in case something goes wrong.
Because they can.
Right. Beyond that, though, that happened maybe in the height of the beginnings of COVID in March. You know, there has been a campaign to actually, of course, you know, put those vaccines in South Africa, in the Republic. They're probably there, right? And how do Africans, you know, stop that? We are so weak. We really are. So even when we publicly, you know, appeal, you know, we you know, I was listening to the African Union. He was the, what was he, the CDC Secretary General. He came to Harvard giving a talk about Africa's response. And the panelists and audiences, you know, from the World Health Organization, from the American CDC, all pushing him to acknowledge that vaccines would be good, you know, vaccine trials would be good to occur in Africa. He made a statement over and over again that we would like you in the West to see or collaborate with Africans around other things, our science. You know, we have a lot of science to bear, you know,
that's right,
around these questions, not just for vaccine trials, right? You know, and so there was a heated sort of discussion around that, but it's just so difficult.
And unfortunately, most of it comes down to perception.
Yeah.
Really, I think, not just founded on anything factual. Right. When it comes to reparation, what's your take on that?
Does it have to be fought separately, where African Americans fight for it in America? Haiti fights for it separately. Maybe somewhere someone fights for it in Brazil. And then the continent itself, Africa, fights for it. Or does it have to be a global effort where we all do it together?
So I like the global effort. And here's why. I've lived in America for 34 years. I came here after college in Nigeria and came to go to grad school.
Yeah.
And, you know, I there's a contending, you know, sort of forces in terms of relations between African immigrants and African-American, ethnic African-Americans or, you know, American Africans, you know, sort of, and, you know, and it really was also spearheaded by Skip Gates's, you know, unfortunate, you know, sort of notion, well, you know, simplification of the transatlantic slave trade, sort of now sort of referring it to the African slave trade, and well, Africans had slavery and this was an extension of African slavery and the Africans sold their African brothers and sisters. And so there's this movement now called the, we are kinds of African Americans are descendants of slavery in America. That's how we distinguish ourselves from, you know, recent Black immigrants like myself. And I say to them, I'm also a descendant of African enslaved in America. We all are. And, you know, and so I try to push my African-American brothers and sisters to understand that the racial determination, you know, begins with Africa. It begins with the European African encounter, you know, and it intertwines us, you know, and, you know, we really do have to have, you know, that global pan-African solidarity, you know, as a starting point, right? And the other thing is, notwithstanding, okay, I'm not going to sugarcoat history, you know, although, you know, history is complex. I don't believe that Africans, you know, the huge continent that it is, of course, it was not that, you know, during the slave trade, it was, you know, different acephalous, you know, units, political units, ranging from small acephalous communities like the Igbo, you know, which didn't really have strong, you know, governments, whereas our neighboring Yorubas had these big federated you know, city states, and even the Hausa in Nigeria had, you know, sort of empires and, you know, larger nation states, right? You know, and so, you know, Africa is complex that way. And so those who did get involved with the slave trade, you know, individuals and units, you know, but it's, you can't say the whole of Africa, you know, sold. Yeah. This was a European endeavor. They came to Africa, you know, and the first sightings of slavery was the kidnappings of Africans. And this is documented actually by the Afonso, King of Bakongo, where the Portuguese, you know, was coming in and saying it was trading and actually kidnapping and taking them back to Portugal to experiment on this plantation slavery over there, right? You know, so the onus is on the Europeans. They came, and whether whoever colluded with them, it's their problem, you know? And they did this after the Enlightenment, you know, where they had committed themselves to human freedom, yet they enslaved, you know, Africans, you know, and so they have to. If I believe in reparations, if alone, it needs to be that Europeans need to acknowledge this wrong in history, which they have never done, you know, and the Americans have to acknowledge it, you know, and acknowledge, you know, how disadvantageous, you know, slavery was for brothers and sisters who were brought here, you know, the legacies currently up to today, but also for, you know, the continent in terms of making way for colonialism and really the difficulties that we have in, you know, in achieving, you know, integration, prosperity, like the rest of the world, right? We need that acknowledgement. And so I believe in reparations for that. You know, I need to hear, you know, Europeans and Americans to acknowledge their role in slavery, the wrongdoing of slavery, and that it will never happen again. And also maybe they need to also acknowledge the resources that communities of Africans and Africans in the diaspora, Africans in the diaspora perhaps more so, you know, the resources they need to rebuild their societies.
Yeah, we need Europe to acknowledge that. Even Namibia was a great case where actually there's a German or Namibian Holocaust, we should say, where they recognize it, but still don't want to apologize for it.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing. But I think part of it comes down to, because the world, generally speaking, the world understands one thing, economics, right?
Yep.
With the African free continental free trade area, I mean, if we have one voice when it comes to trade between Africa and the rest of the world, maybe that's where our leverage is. Last section, racism. And I know it's deeper than that, but just to simplify it a bit, it comes down to respect, I think. I look at a human being and see a human being. My problem is, even when you fight racism, the concept of people of color, can you fight racism without fighting that? Isn't it where the source is?
I think people of color comes with a trend of sort of muting, you know, initiatives like affirmative action and calling it diversity. In the diversity, people of color, and people of color coalitions. And, you know, we're having these discussions at the micro level. I don't know where you are. Are you in New York? New York City?
I'm in New York, yeah.
Okay. So here, you know, in Boston, you know, at the micro level, and when I say the micro level, the work level, for example, you know, everyone is looking to see how we can use Floyd's martyrdom, really, to induce structural change in our workplaces, in our, you know, home lives, right? You know, yeah. I think, you know, I thank the, you know, especially Democrats in the US, you know, liberals who, you know, are open to that kind of, you know, dialogue and change. You know, so we're thinking at our workplace, what is blackness? You know, should we be in coalition with, you know, other groups of color who, you know, there's relative, you know, sort of marginalization and discrimination according to Mahmoud Mamdani, who does this wonderful book in South Africa, Citizen and Subject, he looks at the hierarchies, right? You know, yeah. The blacks in South Africa were still at the bottom, you know, whereas the coloreds, you know, and Indians and Malay were privileged over them, right? You know, and that, you know, sometimes is how people of color, you know, yeah. sort of colorism, you know, hierarchy works with, you know, the global South. Unfortunately, you know, the Africans or the blacks are still, you know, the most marginalized groups. So, you know, I think we need to, I have been on official documentation as saying, look, you know, we do need to, the George Floyd phenomenon of anti-black police brutality is a black thing. Right, you know, it's why does it, you know, affect the core of this country? Even when other groups say, oh well, you know, I mean, it's not so bad for me, you know, is yeah, that's the question. That why is it that a group of peoples, we call them African Americans today, who have, you know, lived and sacrificed, you know, in this country since the 16th and 17th centuries, right? Yeah. Right, you know, are still, you know, marginalized, you know, on every economic indicator that there is today, right? You know, including, you know, the kind of police brutality that we are experiencing, right? There's something about blackness and race that we need to articulate. And I still say to even my colleagues, African-American colleagues, that you, Africa is still part of that, right? You know, the Amadou Diallo was a Guinean, you know, immigrant, who was a continental-born African, right?
That's correct.
You know, in America. But nobody knew that, right? You know, he was shot 41 times, right? You know, so it's something about blackness, right? And blackness and race, we need to sort that out, right? You know, and so my hope is when I tell my colleagues, my hope is when I say this is not about brown right now, it doesn't mean that I am not acknowledging coalitional struggles of diversity and people of color. I acknowledge that. But I do, you know, want us to, at this moment, focus on the issue of race and blackness.
That's the reality.
That's the core, yeah. You know, of the problem.
Yeah, because as long as we have a standard, because I can't look at myself as anything but me. I'm standard. If you are different, then you are different. I'm not different from you. That's just the way it is for me.
No, my brother, you are absolutely right. You know, yeah. And that's why we want to attack the problem systemically, you know, as structural racism, right? You know, and how, you know, racialism, you know, began in Africa, where you just racialize this whole group of people, you know, us, you know, yeah. And our descendants, you know, and racialized us through social Darwinism, you know, said we were, you know, nearest to the apes, you know, racialized, you know, notion of our being primitive, that has sort of evolved into, you know, we just can't get things done, you know, we don't have civilization, we don't have culture, we don't have history, all these things, you know, is what is still implicit in the racialization of the African American, right? You know?
Yes.
And so this is why I tell the African Americans, this is a global struggle to the extent that it's a Pan-African struggle. It's a Pan-African struggle, and it's all about blackness, and that we have to, you know, we have to work together in demystifying it and changing it.
Dr. Edoje, thank you. The music is performed and provided by Lusa Boy, and the conversation continues on Twitter and Facebook, and you can find a transcript of this episode on our website, unmuted.africa. And don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify.